This week I'm joined once again by writer and occultist John Michael Greer. In this episode we discuss his latest translation of Giordano Bruno's On the Shadows of the Ideas. We discuss Giordano Bruno's Art of Memory alongside Hermeticism and Magic in the Renaissance. I would like to say a big thank you to all my patrons for making all this work possible, and if you would like to support Hermetics Podcast or join the Hermetics community, please find our Patreon, donation, Discord and merchandise links in the description below. Enjoy. So John Michael Greer, thanks again for joining us on Hermetics Podcast.
Well, thank you for having me on.
So we're going to be talking about your, I believe it's your latest translation, and I'll have to take a big breath in to say the entire title, which is On the Shadows of the Ideas, Comprising an Art of Investigating, Discovering, Judging, Ordering, and Applying, set forth for the purpose of inner writing and not for vulgar operations of memory. That is the full title of De Umbris Idearum by Giordano Bruno. So we'll jump into the specifics of the book later on, but I thought before we start, maybe a little bit on Bruno himself, because he's obviously one of the biggest, most well-known occult figures ever. Born 1548, dies in 1600, an Italian Dominican friar, philosopher, mathematician, poet, cosmologist, and probably outside of Hermes himself, the most well-known Hermetic occultist who ever lived. Quite literally a Renaissance man, and outside of the burnt at the stake fame, what do you make of Giordano Bruno?
Okay, well, one thing to keep in mind, Bruno's great art, the thing that he worked on more than anything else, was the art of memory. We hardly even think of that these days. We've got our pocket gimmicks and all these things to make up for memory. But in the Renaissance, of course, the idea was that you trained and developed your human capacities. You didn't replace them with machines. The original art of memory was invented in ancient Greece. It was developed also by the Romans. It used a series of visual images to encode things that had to be remembered. It made use of the strengths of the human memory to make up for its weaknesses. And it was very effective. It's one thing that almost always people who haven't tried it find hard to believe. It actually does work. Now, this got rediscovered in the late Middle Ages. People ran with it, and you had this series of increasingly complex, rich, astonishingly useful and effective methods of memory training, and Bruno came at the absolute high water mark of that. The Dominican order, which he was in until he got thrown out as a heretic, the Dominican order had specialized in memory training. They did a lot of work in that field, and among other things, their whole original reason for being was to train preachers. And it really helps if you're going to be preaching a sermon if you don't have to be looking at your notes. So he got the standard memory training of his time, and he was really good at it. He was so good at it that as a very young man, little more than a boy, he was taken by his superiors to Rome to show off his memory abilities to the Pope. He was a genius at memory. And so when he left the monastery, when he fled Italy about two steps ahead of the Inquisition, when he spent doing his rounds in various parts of Europe, the main thing that he worked on first of all was teaching his art, the art of memory that he devised, which, as he points out, is not just for, quote, vulgar operations of memory. It's not just for remembering laundry lists. It's literally a method for working with ideas, working with concepts, memorizing what you learn and what you do with them, but also interacting them, combining them, working with them the way we would like to think computers do.
So the sort of unfortunate, we're talking about memory, and the one thing we collectively remember about Bruno is that he was a heretic, he was burnt at the stake. What do you make of this, the fact that this is the thing that we remember, you know, that there's a disproportionate amount of history regarding occultism, which is, you know, I'm sure we could stack books on witch burnings and heresy and trials, you know, until we reach the moon. What do you make of that?
Well, partly there's this long history in modern times since the late 1600s, actually, on to the present, where you have an ongoing quarrel between secularists and religious and Christian traditionalists over issues of religion. We see it with the current angry atheists and so on. It's all part of the same cultural dialogue. And one of the standard tropes in that whole game is for the various rationalists to insist that Christianity is bad because it burns people at the stake. And so you have these entire books. I'm reminded here, a long time ago, this is in Britain, there was a charming little book called Fox's Book of Martyrs, which was a list of all the people that Queen Mary put to death because they were Protestants. And it went on in lurid detail about this person burned at the stake, and that person burned at the stake, and this person subjected to barbarous torture and burned at the stake. It was a way of whipping up the sort of anti-Catholic sentiment that, of course, was very popular in England for a great many years. Nobody's actually gotten together and put, as far as I know, and put together the secular Book of Martyrs. But Bruno has been one of the poster children for that. And it's actually really funny, because you can read, if you go outside of the circles that actually pay attention to what he was saying, there are any number of accounts of Bruno that quietly erase the fact that the guy was an occultist. No, he was a pioneering rationalist who believed in infinity of worlds, and that's why they fried him at the stake, because they hate reason. It's, you know, it's all part of that onward, back and forth war, sibling rivalry between dogmatic materialism and dogmatic religion.
It's funny you mentioned that, because while I was doing the research into this, I briefly checked Amazon. You can sort of, it's quite funny really, you can click on you can find a Giordano Bruno book and click on Giordano Bruno as if he set up his own page and find the books there. And you're scrolling along and you see all these sort of self-published occult ones, and then there's one sort of Cambridge scholars philosopher one. And it's peculiar that, you know, there's always a difficulty when you have what at the time were considered philosophers, and now the term is so vague. So, for instance, you know, Descartes now would be considered a scientist, or Leibniz would be considered primarily a mathematician. And it's interesting to think, well, if Giordano Bruno was working today, what would he be? Maybe he'd just be considered a nut, but he certainly isn't coming up in discussions of philosophy. That's sort of my...
Yeah, well, now the thing you have to remember here is that an enormous amount of medieval and Renaissance philosophy has been erased from our collective memory. When I was finishing up my college degree, so quite a few years ago now, I did one of those series of classes where they did ancient philosophy and medieval philosophy and modern philosophy, okay? And the ancient philosophy started with the pre-Socratics and ended with a crunch with Aristotle. You then jump 1,000 years with a brief nod to Augustine. And then all of a sudden you're in Anselm and the Scholastics. And you take the Scholastics and you go through that up through, I think it was Nicholas of Cusa. And then you take a leap from there and all of a sudden you're Leibniz. And there are these huge tracts of time that are left over and nobody talks. Most of the surviving philosophy we have from the ancient world dates from after Aristotle. We have all the Neoplatonists, we have all the Stoics, we have the Epicureans, we have an enormous wealth of philosophy, but we don't talk about them, especially we don't talk about the Neoplatonists. Then you get to Renaissance philosophy. Setting aside, you know, there's this thin stream of more or less rationalist stuff, but there was this immense Renaissance Neoplatonism, Renaissance Hermeticism, this very rich philosophical tradition that explored an enormous amount of stuff, and then it was shoved under the rug. There's a very nice book, a very useful book by Paolo Rossi, in English translation, it's called Logic and the Art of Memory. And one of the things that it talks about is the way that the central intellectual preoccupations of the Renaissance, things like the art of memory, things like the idea of what was called a real character, the idea of characters that were symbols that actually communicated the essence of what they were about, rather than being arbitrary signs. Okay, the idea of combinatorial logic, which is something that Bruno got into, where you get a set of very basic concepts and you combine them in an algebra of ideas. These were things that were central to intellectual thought all through the Renaissance. They were central to Bruno's work. They were central to the work of hundreds of really interesting thinkers. But from about 1700 on, we do not talk about them. They are verboten. And when Francis Yates broke the taboo with her book, Giordano Bruno and the Hermetic Tradition. The sudden shocked in-breath from university faculties across the Western world, it was as though somebody dropped their pants at the vicar's garden party. It was because you don't talk about these things.
No, most definitely not. And it's I remember Orlov has that joke.
Oh yeah,
you should see you should look at a leftist when you give them two counteracting ideas. You know, two ideas which don't mix, and then they have to work them out, and they'll sort of implode. And I sort of think maybe you could extend that joke and say, look at the face of an academic philosopher when you tell them that one of their favorite philosophers also dabbled in occultism. They'll probably but it begs a really big question, actually, because I think there's a clear reason why I think the Neoplatonists aren't touched on, and it seems to me that when you read the Neoplatonists, it's unavoidable that they not even dabbled. You know, it's part of their system that they dabbled in what we now consider occult. Whereas with Plato, there is traditionally they're called something, not the hidden manuscripts, but the unwritten doctrines,
yeah.
I think, something along those lines.
Yes. The references to those, and things like the seventh letter, we can all just pretend that was never written, or it's, you know, we're going to deny its authenticity, even though it has better claim than some of the dialogues.
Yeah,
yeah, exactly.
And we can also deny, like in the study of mathematics, we can deny Pythagoras is you know, his entire class structure of like almost master slave weird strange relationships he had, and the divine properties of shapes and geometry and things along these lines. So what do you think it is then that is the sort of cultural difference between, you know, what we could fit into the Neoplatonist or Renaissance philosophical models, which just there's something in there that instantly is sort of gut level abhorrent to the academic, the contemporary academic.
Yeah. There's a couple of things going on here. On the one hand, you've got to remember that most of the people who founded modern science were up to their eyeballs in occultism. The Royal Society was a hotbed of occultism. Isaac Newton's put more energy into practicing alchemy than he put into understanding gravity. This was pervasive. And so as science became institutionalized and as science developed a sort of modus vivendi with the Victorian Christianity especially, all of that had to be stuffed into the closet really far, really fast. We do not talk about it. You know, it's very much as though somebody, an upwardly mobile person in a class-ridden society, was desperately trying to pretend that their great grandfather was not shoveling muck in a pigsty. So there's a very definite sort of nouveau riche attitude, a sort of clinging to the illusion that the ancestors of science were something other than the wizards and alchemists they actually were. But there's a crucial factor here, which is that the entire structure of modern science is based on a falsification. The idea that you can separate the observer from the thing that's observed. It's a useful fiction. It's a really useful fiction. You can do some amazing things with experimental science if you do everything possible to pretend that the observer doesn't affect the thing observed. But it's still a fiction. And magic, occultism, alchemy, all these things are about the participation of the observer in the observed. And so whenever magic comes up, whenever occultism comes up, whenever alchemy comes up, all of a sudden scientists are having to confront the fact that their entire system is built on a useful fiction. And of course that causes a gut-level abhorrence. It's rather like the old jokes about how Easter's been canceled this year, they found the body. It's precisely the same to them. The idea that there can be a perfectly objective, perfectly rational explanation for the entire cosmos is based on a fiction, is based on that false claim that the observer doesn't really exist and doesn't really interface with the observed, that that we can just pretend that minds don't exist. And if they do exist, they're just these little bubbles of thought trapped in lumps of meat called human brains, and they certainly don't affect anything, even though you know better any time you reach for something.
It's interesting you say that. I recently had a chat with someone about the philosophy of someone called Michel Serres, who's written a 3-volume work on the god Hermes and communication. One of the things he says in that is that no, should we say, logos is privileged. So you can't cordon off something. Like, that's all science does, is they cordon it off and say, well, this is the privileged art, or the privileged science, or the privileged system of knowledge, and it's sort of self-justifying in that way, that its own language justifies its own means. So I think one big question here, Bruno, as working as a hermeticist and known as one of the, like I said, one of the most well-known hermeticists, along with perhaps Franz Bardon. I'm trying to think of others who famously have worked in that tradition.
I would point to a couple of the really great alchemists. I would point to Cornelius Agrippa. I would point to Marsilio Ficino, who translated the Corpus Hermeticum and launched that back into European society. I would point to Francis Barrett, the author of the Magus. I would point to the founders of the Golden Dawn. That's about, and by the time you, and Eliphas Levi, of course, and by the time you've run through those, you've basically run through the list of people who are even in Bruno's league. Because he's a huge figure. He's a
And
colossal figure.
can we then consider, I hope I'm pronouncing this correctly, De Umbris Idearum? Can we consider it a work of Hermeticism, or is this art of memory something different? And how would you explain Hermeticism to those who?
Okay. Well, the thing is, when we talk about Hermeticism, we're talking about a moving target. Here's what we know. In Egypt, after Alexander the Great's armies conquered it, so we're talking Hellenistic Egypt, Egypt where the upper class spoke Greek and the lower class still spoke Demotic Egyptian. In that setting, right around the time of the birth of Christ, there were schools that taught a system of thought that had some connections to Gnosticism and some connections to Neoplatonism and some connections to the old Orphic and Pythagorean mysteries. It kind of mixed all this stuff up together. And the people in this tradition wrote a series of dialogues in which Hermes Trismegistus, Hermes the thrice great, was one of the main characters, was the one who was explaining, okay, this otat is true about the world, and so on. So we have this parcel of 14 dialogues. Rome falls. The Dark Ages show up. The Muslims invade. Chaos, discord, confusion, consternation, moral warp, all the usual stuff. And then in 1452, I believe it was, Constantinople falls to the Ottomans, and people flee from the conquest, taking the most precious things they had. And one of the things that got out with some scholar was a single volume which contained these 14 hermetic dialogues. There may have been thousands of them. We don't know. This one copy is the only one that survived. And so this ended up in the hands of the Medici in Florence. It was Lorenzo de' Medici, and who was the patron of Marsilio Ficino, who was the absolute hotshot intellectual of the time, and who had been assigned the process of translating all the dialogues of Plato into Latin so everyone could read them, because every educated person could read Latin in those days. So he got pulled off that project in a hurry and handed these 14 dialogues and said, Marsilio, this is the real stuff. So Ficino translated this stuff into Latin, translated the Corpus Hermeticum, and unleashed it on the Western world. And all of a sudden, people from one end of Europe to the other picked up this thing and go, wow. Because A, it's a religious cosmology. It is similar to Christianity, without some of the more problematic features. And of course, the idea was, the belief at that time was that Hermes Trismegistus was an actual person, that he lived around the same time as Moses. So here we have the Gospel of Hermes dating from before the Christian Gospel, and it's this profoundly moving series of mystical tracts. So, of course, occultists from all over Europe piled it. And there were also some books, supposedly by Hermes, that had to do with alchemy. And of course, he was the patron of the alchemical art. So a lot of alchemists got into this stuff too. And around this manuscript, you had this boiling cultural ferment. Of course, the Catholic Church did what it usually does in such things and desperately tried to burn a lot of people at the stake. Bruno was one of the ones who got caught. But that was the magical side of the Renaissance. That was where Renaissance occultism came from the ferment that was kick-started off by the discovery of those 14 dialogues. And ever since then, there have been people in the Western world who have turned to either to those dialogues or to some of the traditions that were brought into being by them, and said, "Yes, this, you know, this is my faith. This is what I'm. This is the path I follow. This is the vision of the universe that makes sense to me." So that's Hermeticism. You get an enormous number of people in, and with an enormous number of very diverse ideas. Was Bruno one of them? Absolutely. He was, by all accounts, deeply into the cosmology of the Corpus Hermeticum. He studied that carefully. He also studied the kind of book that would really quickly get you invited to one of those barbecues by the Inquisition, the Picatrix, which was a book of Arab sorcery written in the 10th century, probably in Spain, if not in the section of Africa right next to it, and which contains much of the late occultism, sorcery, astrological magic of the classical world. It's an amazing book. Bruno had a copy. We know this because some of the symbolic images that only appeared in the Picatrix, or only appeared at that time, appear in On the Shadows of the Ideas and in some of Bruno's other works. So he wasn't just reading the Corpus Hermeticum. He was up to his eyeballs in the deepest, strangest, most dangerous, you know, for your personal survival, end of Hermeticism and of Renaissance occultism. So On the Shadows of the Ideas is not, it doesn't go around blaring the fact that it's about occultism. But a lot of the memory images that he gives are images from astrological magic, and they're obviously intended to be used as such. And in fact, Bruno wrote several really interesting essays on magic. And one of the projects I have in mind down the road a bit, they've been translated in an academic translation, but frankly, it's not really useful for practitioners. And I'm looking at that saying, you know, somebody needs to put this into language that people can use. But we'll get to that in a few, you know, once I have translated that, we'll get to that in a future, podcast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I mean, he couldn't make this too clear, because I do believe it was his first publication.
Mm-hmm, yeah, exactly.
What we know.
Well, this is the first thing that he actually published. We know he wrote something called the Clavis Magna, the Greater Key. Nobody knows what happened to it. He certainly never published it.
Is there any theories?
There people have been digging around trying to see if there might be a manuscript somewhere, and so far nothing has surfaced. It's entirely possible, given his mnemonic abilities, that he had the whole thing memorized and it was never written down, in which case it went up in smoke when he did. But he gives a lot of hints and a lot of clues. And in my translation, in the afterword, I spend some time trying to figure out what we can know about the system of the Clavius Magna, how it was structured, and how he was using it both as an art of memory and as the kind of combinatorial logic I mentioned before that takes a set of basic concepts and then combines them in different ways.
So what is your understanding of the philosophy of Hermeticism then in brief? I mean, I'm sure, of course, that something such as the Corpus Hermeticum, you know, there's never going to be an agreed upon reading, but what?
No, kind of the summary of the Hermetic philosophy. First of all, it's a philosophy of emanation. The idea is that the material world is the densest, the most recalcitrant, the least important of a cascading series of worlds descending from the divine unity. So you have the divine world, which creates the spiritual world, which creates the mental world, which creates the what later occultists would have called the astral world, the world of images and dreams and visions and so on, which creates the world of life force, which creates the world of matter. And all these worlds are interconnected. They're not separate. There's certain stages between them, but you can pass the thing. Creative force flows down from the highest level to right down here on Earth, and so from within Hermetic philosophy, we are all part of this process of ongoing creation that begins at the divine plane and it is constantly cascading down in a manifestation here. So that's one basic concept of Hermetic philosophy. Another basic concept is the idea that we are not just meat. Okay, each of us has at our core a spark, a scintilla, synteresis, to use the Greek term, a spark of the divine essence. And that's the core of our being. Everything has that spark. But we have these things, and we have the spark in us. And because of that, we can transcend the material. We've descended through the planes all the way down into matter, and now it's our destiny to go back up the planes, level by level, mastering them, till we have become mighty spiritual beings. We're not there yet. We're about halfway through a very long pilgrimage. But there's this idea of descent and return, that we are not just, you know, as I said, we're not just meat. We're not just, you know, we're born, we die, we rot, that's it. We're spiritual beings who are currently in material incarnation. That's a central concept of Hermeticism. A third concept, and a crucial one, is the concept of correspondences. Basically, everything you see is connected to something in the realm of the unseen, and in each of the realms of the unseen. So that, you know, this is why you can take, say, an herb, and this herb corresponds to the sun, and it corresponds to all these other things on the various planes that represent the sun that carry the same creative energy. And so you can use that herb in magic because it has that burst of creative energy that is akin to the sun. So if you put those three together, that's kind of the basic framework within which different Hermeticists work, within which different forms of Hermetic philosophy develop and work out their own particular variations.
It sounds you make it sound relatively straightforward.
It is. it's just that it offends the stuffing out of rationalists and materialists and atheists.
Yeah, I mean now you the way you've put it there though, it does actually make because I spent a lot of time reading this book. This is I always do a fair amount of research for these interviews, and this is the one where I had to do a lot because the first sort of three quarters of the book, it's not straightforward, but it's take your time. It's not too bad, and then when it gets to the method, I found it got a bit more complex. But one of the things, I mean, now you've put Hermeticism like that. I think I assume that the reality was that not many people around Bruno, you know, the average person or should be reading that stuff. So hopefully, you know, he was just in a camp where it's like, well, they shouldn't be reading it, so they won't know. But you know, one of the things within this system of memory is he puts forward this reliance on all the senses and bringing back all the senses into a form of imagery. So that connects to what you were saying about these connections between...
It's also, by the way, really useful if you want to do anything with visualization, anything with creative imagination, and anything with the art of memory. The more of your senses you can build into your imagination, the better. It's, you know, if you're trying to visualize something, let's say, because you want to bring it about, don't just settle for the image. Make it, get the sound, get the scent, get the weight, get the texture and the heft of it. And it makes it much more powerful. Many magicians know this already, and those that don't need to learn it. But in fact, Bruno was absolutely right. If you want to remember, let's say, you know, you're doing a really simple art of memory, the kind of art of memory that you're using to, say, remember a shopping list on the way to the grocery store. Take each thing in this sequence of memory images and make it concrete, make it vivid, make it heavy, give it scent, give it texture, give it flavor, and it will stick in your memory like nobody's business.
And one of the interesting things I found is that right at the start, he makes it very clear in... I hadn't read much Bruno firsthand before. He's a real... he reminds me of James Kunstler, actually. He's a real cantankerous fellow, shall we say?
Oh, he is.
And but one thing he makes clear very quickly is he is like, this is going to be difficult. Don't bother unless you're willing to put in some effort. And is this something that's unique to the Renaissance, or, you know, we've lost this. We've lost this culture of you're going to have to work for this.
Well, it was something that was very common in his time. The idea that we have nowadays that, you know, every knowledge should be available for all. We have books for the complete idiot. We have books for dummies. That was antithetical to the Renaissance idea. Their idea was that knowledge is naturally secret. You still get these in some of the old initiatory orders. You still get this in some of the old trade guilds, where there are secrets that are passed on. You promise not to reveal them because knowledge is naturally secret. It belongs to the people who've earned it. Bruno was very much in that tradition. His idea was that if you have the what it takes to master this art, okay, it's yours. You have that power. If you don't, bug off. And that was a normal attitude in his time. He now, of course, he added his own, as you say, he was kind of a cantankerous git. Well, actually, the one of Bruno's great problems throughout his life is he suffered from a smartest guy in the room syndrome. He was unable to see himself as anything but smarter than anybody else, and that's one of the reasons they caught him and burned him at the stake, because he didn't realize that he could be tricked and trapped, as in fact he was. But so yeah, he got snarky. He got very seriously snarky. Of course, he got very funny. In the opening dialogue where he has Hermes and two other people who are talking about Bruno's book. Here we've got this book. Well, what do you think about this? What do you think about that? And Logifer, who's kind of the challenging figure who's saying this book should never be published, come on, keeps on bringing up all of these standard comments by people in Bruno's own time. The various respectable scholars about how memory training doesn't work and you might as well do this. And blah de blah. Except, of course, Bruno puts in the mouth of fictitious authorities with names like Dr. Enema. And Professor Idiot. And so he I don't think it ever sunk in that he made a lot of enemies that way.
Yeah, I mean, he's one of those figures from history that I think is hard, quite hard to grasp. And I wonder how much or how correct the famous statue of him with his sort of extremely like relatively handsome with his hooded cloak and looking very sort of elusive, like probably how Mr. Crowley imagined himself to be. But, everyone's you know what I
Oh
mean,
yeah,
though. Everyone's
I know what you mean.
stereotypical image of the stealthy, shall we say, the stealthy rogue sort of roaming through the crowds and thinking they're all that. And I wonder, it's all you. It's always how do people actually see him while he was roaming around with his hood up in sunny Italy? Question to be had. Yeah, I mean, what do you make of Bruno?
Bruno, he was a complex guy. He did have a huge disadvantage of being a child prodigy, and so yeah, he had a bad case of being convinced that he knew better than everyone else. He was kind of a jerk. He was a genius, but he was kind of a jerk, and it eventually blew up in his face. And but within his fields, within the fields that he studied, nobody was better. And so, well, I'm not a great fan of Aleister Crowley, but those people who are, I know that a significant number of them have to kind of set aside the guy's personality and just pay attention to what he wrote. And that's true. That's true of many, many thinkers. We have this, we have this delusion, I should say, nowadays in contemporary pop culture, that if somebody is good, they have to be 100% good at 100% of the things they do, and if they do anything bad, they're bad 100%. We should throw them out. That's stupid. And it's usually also a way that people that the third rate talents these days use to try to pretend that people who are better than they were shouldn't be read. But you really do need to get past that. You need to recognize that writers such as Bruno are human beings. Some of them are jerks. Some of them say stupid things on occasion. But that doesn't change the fact that their ideas can be enormously powerful and very much worth reading. Bruno's a great example. If you really want to master the Renaissance art of memory, you've got to confront Bruno. You've got to deal with him. You've got to soak yourself in his ideas because he understood that stuff better than anybody else. And if you decide, well, no, Bruno's a jerk, I'm not going to pay any attention to him, you're the loser.
And to move into Bruno's ideas, to begin with this concept of the shadow, or which suddenly reminded me of the previous interview we did where you mentioned I think it was the 70s character of the shadow.
The shadow. No. The shadow was early 20th century. Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men? The shadow knows. It was great, yeah. So, unfortunately, Bruno was not dealing with that shadow. It would make for a hilarious mashup fantasy
He, it seems to
to
me,
have Bruno as a kind of Renaissance the shadow.
yeah. Maybe. Someone needs to write it, I think. A
Somebody
sort of
needs to write that one. That could be enormously fun.
a buddy cop duo where Bruno is your sort of asshole partner. Deal with a neighbor. And he, but in the
My, yeah, try
20th, but in the 21st century, so everyone else is using databases and computers and he's trying to
you could do
memorize.
that. No, it's strike the thing you see what would strike me is to find some other figure in Renaissance Europe and have him palling around with Bruno and have the two of them, you know, having to dodge the Inquisition, and you know you have to deal with Bruno being a jerk, and but a brilliant jerk, and just, and it spins away into silliness. It could be a lot of fun, but we digress.
My reading of the shadow might be wrong, is that if we the probably the most famous allegory ever on light and darkness, Plato's allegory of the cave. If we were to understand this concept of the shadow in terms of that, then what the Hermetic understanding then would be that we understand light from the sun or wherever, but light in general as a form of truth, and even the light that's coming from the torches, which are casting the shadows, is a form of truth, and therefore that there is some truth retained in the shadows or what Kant would call representation, or what we call the material world. There is some truth retained within this. Am I somewhere on the mark there with that?
Yeah, well, the thing is, the great dividing point between the old classical mystic traditions is, does the world contain truth? Does the world reflect the divine, or does it not? And on the one hand, you have figures like Plotinus, the great Neoplatonist philosopher, for whom the material world is a reflection of the true world as close as possible. And you also get this in Plato's Timaeus, of course. You know, this is time is a moving representation of eternity. The material cosmos is the most perfect world that can be, and it echoes the world of the ideas as perfectly as matter can. On the other hand, you have the Gnostic end of the spectrum, the sort of hardcore dualist Gnostic, where the world is a black iron prison made of lies, and we are trapped here, and there is no truth in the world, and we must flee from it and, you know, escape to the aeonic world of light. And that created polarity between there's truth in the world, there's no truth in the world, gave rise to a lot of the ancient mystical traditions and helped guide them in important ways. Bruno is kind of dancing on both sides of that because he has the shadows of the ideas, and then he has his shadow and he has his light. Now he's associating this, by the way, with Aristotle and Plato. The 30 shadows of the ideas. That's the realm of shadows, the realm of material existence, the realm of Aristotelian philosophy, which deals so much with material existence. And then the 30 aspects of light that come after that, those all have to do with Platonic philosophy. Because he was trying to come up, among other things, he was trying to come up with a way to integrate those two great traditions. It was a common project in his time. And until somebody can figure out more about the greater key, we won't know how well he did. But that seems to have been one of his basic goals here, to take Aristotelian scientific thought, the best scientific thought that was available in his time, and integrate that with Platonic mysticism. So he was kind of dancing on that border. Are the shadows cast by the light of the sun, or are they cast by the light of torches? Well, it depends.
What would
Maybe, you know, from some direct, in some ways of saying, both of those can be appropriate ways of looking at it. Go on.
yeah, so what would if we take the sun in terms of metaphor there as sort of the truth, then what how would we understand torches? Is that sort of a seer or a prophet metaphorically?
Basically, if the torches then become representations of the truth, so they may be as close as we can get. You know, if the sun has set, you light a candle. It's not much, but it's better than sitting in the darkness. And so, and you know, you could take the metaphor to a great deal of complexity, point out that the torches are made of wood, which grew in, you know, from trees exposed to sunlight and this kind of stuff. And I'm not sure whether he would have pursued that. But certainly you have, and there is the question, okay, are those shadows being cast by torches? Or are those shadows being cast by sunbeams that are finding their way down into the cave? And that was one of the sort of back and forth that you get between philosophers after Plato. Was he right about the torches? Or was that just a metaphor?
Well, I think one of the quotes I really, really loved, because it articulated something that I've struggled to articulate for a long time. It's actually fairly straightforward within this text regarding darkness and light. And Bruno says, some have lost their vision in trying to too suddenly turn from darkness into light. And my mind instantly went to the likes of basically Crowley, Terence McKenna, the entire era of psychonauts who find some artificial way. Instead of taking the instead of assessing what it is that they've done, they sort of take, you know, if it's a 10-step program, they jump in at number 9 without actually ever having the preparatory material. And I don't know how you'd read that. You know, what happens when someone too suddenly goes into the light?
Yeah, well, Terence McKenna is a great example. They end up making these grand theoretical proclamations and predictions, which don't turn out to be correct, because they've misunderstood what they're experiencing. There's a Zen saying, lots of Zen sayings about enlightenment. It's the main thing they work about. But they say a person who attains instantaneous complete enlightenment is like an arrow shot straight into hell. You have to get there a little bit at a time, and Plato says this in the Republic. You know, you're a person who gets free of the chains and picks his way up the slope of the cave, bit by bit. He's dazzled. There's this overwhelming light, and it takes him a long time before he can even, you know, blinking and peering through narrowed eyes, start seeing things like rocks and trees around him, and only after much, much, much preparation, can he actually raise his eyes and behold the sun? And so that's, you know, Plato was there, of course, dead right. If you jump in too deeply, especially if you're using chemical means or if you're using some of the more robust spiritual practices without the necessary preparation, yeah, you know, what happens is you go crazy. You may go crazy like Crowley and become convinced that, you know, you are the prophet of the eon, and spend the rest of your life being totally baffled by the fact that nobody takes you seriously. Or you may go crazy in various other ways. I think of, I'm not, Christine, I'm forgetting her name. She went by Inquire Within. In the Golden Dawn, she was a temple chief in its last fading years, and ended up becoming. She ended up flipping, becoming paranoid, and becoming a devout fundamentalist Christian conspiracy theorist, and writing books like Light Bearers of Darkness, which was all about the evil Masonic Jewish communist conspiracy that was out to take over the world.
The classic one story look at
Oh yeah,
life.
yeah. Yeah,
It,
exactly,
here's how
exactly.
everything works. I'm glad you
It's, yeah,
yeah.
exactly. It's
Was it?
like Dave, it's like David Icke and his reptiles. You know, his you know, I honestly think there, you know, he was probably smoking way too much weed back in the 1980s when that the utterly forgettable TV show V was on, with the one with the shape-shifting reptiles who controlled people's minds. And Icke was apparently just going, "You're way too much of that," and you know, it sank in too deep. But there he is, you know, with evil reptile, you know, lizards everywhere. Ah!
What's interesting though is Bruno actually does become basically the end, the oft the op, the often end sorry the often forgotten end part of Plato's allegory, which is if he says that if that person who had finally become accustomed to the sun or the truth or the whatever world you whatever metaphor you want to apply to that is dragged back into the cave and tries to explain to the people what they've seen, due to their damaged eyes, the people would assume that they are, you know, of that world, or if they've been attacked or it's dangerous, and they would actually try to take them down. In Bruno's case, that quite literally happened, isn't it?
Yes. Oh, yes. Yeah. It's one of the reasons why there's that the you know the fourth virtue of the mage, you know, to know, to dare, to will, and to be silent. Or as one of my teachers used to like to say, to know, to will, to dare, and to shut the up.
Well, silence is, it seems to me, is has historically always been an extremely key factor in sensible, paced magical training. I mean, even from Pythagoras, that was one of his classic tenets.
He was he Pythagoras was great. His ba one of his basic rules was when you started studying him, you were under a vow of silence for 5 years. Now, if you ever dealt with undergraduates, you know this is a good idea anyway. But yeah, you took a vow of silence, and for 5 years you studied stuff and you did not speak a word. Excellent training for the will, but it also keeps you from, it also teaches you not to chatter. And so by the time you get to the end of the 5 years and okay, now you can start talking again, you actually think about what you're saying.
It does seem that there's a sort of a split tradition there with regards to how people approach this. And I mean, I wonder if, I hope you don't mind me asking, but where do you sit on sort of using, drugs or whatever? I mean, I'm sure there's other ways,
So using psychedelics?
immediate, yeah, psychedelics or I think, like one of those sense deprivation things, like immediate means to.
My point of view is very simple. We've had people doing that for a long time. And they have over and over and over and again proclaimed that, okay, here is the great secret that's going to blow things open. We're all going to be enlightened. And what has actually happened is we've ended up with a lot of burnout drug addicts. Or we've ended up with a lot of just, people who were, like Terence McKenna was perfectly capable of taking care of himself, unlike some. But did he have any significant impact on the world? I mean, other than helping to feed the whole 2012 Mayan Fool's Day business, he did not achieve what the great mystics have achieved, what the great mages have achieved. And so you look, if you compare the results of, these various quick paths with the results that are achieved by people who do it the old-fashioned way, it's very clear that one of those works and one of those does not. So on that basis of, okay, what actually happens, my basic advice is don't go there. Yes, it's fast. Yes, it's, you can pretend that you're, or you can have these wild experiences and, and then at the end of the day, what have you achieved? Not that much. Whereas we can see over and over again people who have done things, taken the traditional approach seriously, done the necessary training, developed the qualities of character and the skills of mind that are developed by that training, and then they go out and do amazing things in the world. And so on that basis, yeah, don't bother with the drugs. There, that's rec that, if you want to do that for recreation, whatever. But I don't recommend combining that with a serious spiritual path. They just don't seem to blend well. The Buddha was right. Intoxicants don't really work well with this stuff.
And probably one of the best occultists who ever lived, Dion Fortune, her sane occultism is roughly based around this entire topic.
Oh yeah, no, she makes a great point. It talks about how the people in her time were talking about how drugs will loosen the girders of the mind, and Fortune points out, well, yes, but they give you no way to tighten them back up. So unless you want to go through life rattling like a cheap motor car, you might want to choose some other approach.
Okay. Back to the shadows. One thing that does interest me with this is there's a short quote that says, "The shadows which emerged from the depths of darkness." Now, it seems that Bruno is making it clear you can't have this shadow which contains or potentially or possibly contains some form of truth without the inverse or suffering or death or the what is stereotypically understood as morbid. You have to take both sides.
Yes, you have to do that. Actually, Dionne Fortune talks about that in her book, The Cosmic Doctrine. What she calls negative evil, which is all of the frustrating and difficult and resistant aspects of life, you have to have those as a thrust block, something to push off against, so that you can get into motion. And so Bruno, what Bruno is talking about is subtle, though. He's saying to have a shadow, you have to have light and you have to have darkness, because the shadow blends the two. The shadow is not perfectly opaque, but it's not perfectly lit. It's the in-between condition that's brought about by the combination of light and darkness, by the combination of a ray of light and something that blocks it, or what have you. And of course, he's quite right. You can't have, you know, you cannot have a world of manifestation unless you have opposites. Lao Tzu, you know, the all under heaven, no good as good only because there is evil.
Which is...
We can know light as light only because there is darkness, you know, and so on and so forth. You can't have a world that only contains one side of a balance. And, of course, that's something that we're seeing a lot of people who are not getting these days, who want everything to be perfect and everything to be, and perfect meaning whatever they want this week. And that leads no place good, because, you know, it's like trying to get a magnet with just a north pole by cutting the thing in half. You have two magnets, each of which have a north and south pole.
And this is sort of reiterated in, there's an early poem which I found particularly great, called Merlin, Merlin the Temperate Judge, which is about a drink which cures the evils of the body. But one of the lines is, if you drink too much, it will trouble you, toss you madly, hurl you gloriously. You know, sort of saying, you, if you had all good, there's nothing there. You you need a, not a binary, but you need some, need to draw the line. You need a border. You need something to react from.
Yeah. Sort of you need yin and yang. You need the balance. You need the balance of those two things, and that's a very difficult thing for a lot of people in the Western world to grasp. That you have to have both sides. You have to have the. You cannot have a balance without that has only one side on it. It's like the running joke about how, you know, in our community all the children are above average.
That certainly sounds like a contemporary American community there, suburban.
Yeah.
Everyone gets an award. I remember school assemblies, and they'd bring out stacks of awards above the knee. You know, we were basically saying we went to a game. We were there. Great.
We were there, yeah.
Devalued all meaning.
Yeah, and yeah, exactly. And they've cursed them. They've just stripped all meaning out of even bothering to try. But yeah,
is this what Bruno means? Because he makes it clear, not explicitly, but he makes it clear throughout the book that that one must use nature as a way to enact this art. You know, it's already inherent in us. But what's inherent is this value of understanding. That we need to work with both good and bad. Is that what he thinks is that we need to be able to work with this?
Yes, very much so. Very much so. You've got to be able to work with both sides. You've got to be able to accept that both sides exist and to work with what is natural. That's something that I think he got from the Stoics, because they were very into that.
So moving on to the system, it begins with these the 30 intentions, and then moves to the 30 concepts. And the 30 intentions, these largely revolve around the ideas of light, darkness, and shadow. And in the 10th intention, we are introduced to this idea that this art of memory is entirely subjective. You cannot use another's work or images to achieve results. And this always seemed to me that the almost like the horrible entry barrier for modern day, you know, budding new occult practitioners is like, oh, well, I can't just use your work. But it's like, no, because the journey, it's your journey.
Well, and the thing is, I think Bruno would have been pleased by all the people going, oh, I can't do that. Well, and Bruno says, no, you can't. You don't have what it takes. That was his style. But in fact, he's also quite correct that, and this was a device found in many memory works at that time, the images that work best vary so much from person to person that what works for you will not work for the other person. So you need to find the images that stick in your own memory. For example, in my when I do art of memory stuff, the things that stick best are really bad puns. So if I can come up with a visual pun, especially a really rancid one, to encode something mnemonically, it sticks like glue. Other people don't have that advantage, if it is one. Peter of Ravenna, who was one of the great teachers of the art of memory in the Renaissance, in the, I think, two generations before Bruno or so, his basic thing was that he would memorize things using images of women that he slept with. He was very oversexed, and so he remembered their bodies very precisely, typically unclothed. And so he would have each of these, you know, these cute naked women holding memory images and so on, and he would remember them just instantly. You know, that's what worked for him. Different people have different mnemonic needs. And so, On the one hand, it's a good, the saying, no, you've got to design your own, is a good entry barrier to screen out people who aren't willing to do the work. But it's also simply a fact of memory that your mind has its own habits, and you work with the habits of your mind rather than following somebody else's gimmicks.
What so my understanding, where this combines into to an art or method of memory, and correct me if I'm wrong at any point, is that it is much alike what people understand as, I think the sort of the most famous book in recent years, which I think was published in 2010, if my memory serves me well, is a book called by Joshua Bower, I think, called Moonwalking with Einstein. Which is
And in
about
fact,
using a memory palace,
yes.
about that, which is sort of the traditional technique, which is or kind of alike this technique, but this one has this idea of not a sphere, a circle, and with inner circles, within which you begin on the outside, usually with a letter or two letters, which then you then continue through, or a character, and then you can place things on this character in your mind. And from the outside of the circle, go in. So it's sort of like a roulette board, in a way.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry, no. That was that's sort of how I would describe it. So what I
Okay,
was going to say.
so basically, again, Bruno came at the high water mark of the art of memory, and the basic method of memory of the memory palace, the imaginary building that you walk through and you have things stashed in your imagination in the various parts of it, that was a starting point. That was a starting point in ancient Greek times. By the time you got to the Middle Ages, there were still a lot of people using that method because it works very well. I've done it myself. But people were starting to look into, okay, what else can you do? And so Bruno's thing, what he didn't do places and images. He had what he called subjects and adjects. And a subject was any image that was a permanent fixture. Okay, and an adject was something you put on the subject to encode something. So, for example, if you were to, you could do a memory sequence that was based on the letters of the alphabet. We'll do a real simple one. Okay, we have 26 places, they A through Z, right? And but you imagine each of these letters as like an object with made a big thing made of wood with some hooks on it. And you can imagine hanging things on those hooks. So you go to A, what's hanging from the A? Well, if you're Peter Verbena, then it's a naked woman. But that, if it's me, it's probably something with a really dreadful pun. You go to B. You go to C. It's not a. It doesn't become a matter of places. It's a matter of images that have images connected to them. So that's the first thing that he was doing, is this subject-adject distinction, and that's crucial for his whole system. And then each of these wheels, each of the wheels of 30 letters, okay, that's a set of 30 subjects. And how many of them do you have? It depends on how many you want. And so you can end up with a set of compound subjects. So we have, just to pull something for the letter A, okay, we have A, three wheels, okay? So Adam, sitting in an armchair with an anteater at his feet. I'm making this up, of course. That gives you the combination AAA. And so that becomes your subject. And then you put something on him. Adam is wearing a funny hat. That tells you something you want to remember. Adam is carrying something in his lap, and the aardvark has something in it between its paws. That gives you three memory images. You then go on to Adam in his armchair with a beaver at his feet, AAB. And then Adam in his armchair with a cat, AAC. And you go through the whole thing. You've just developed a situation with whatever 26 to the third power is. I don't have to remember to have that quick mind for math, but it's a lot of memory places.
Have
Okay.
you do you use this?
I have not taken things to the point of using Bruno's full method. I mean, I've done some experimental work with it to make sure that it functions. But I don't. I mean, most when I do the art of memory, I train. I originally trained out of Francis Yates's book, The Art of Memory. So memory palaces are my standard approach. And when I was, for example, finishing up my college degree, I would use the insides of the various college buildings, and you know this building would have this class, all the notes from this class in it, and so forth. So no, I've not actually worked with Bruno's method. I don't. If I ever need to memorize a whole lot of stuff in a hurry, you bet.
So is that actually the, because now you put it like that, it seems relatively simple. Is that the entirety of the system? Or does Bruno later go on to tweak it
Oh no, he that's the starting point.
at all?
Then he starts showing you how you can actually encode text word for word, which is that was the great challenge of the art of memory. Everyone knew that you could encode ideas, that you could get all of the basic ideas stuck in your head. That's not a problem. But to actually get large chunks of text that you could store and rattle forth word perfect, that was something that Bruno could do, and that a lot of that some other people could do with various advanced methods. And so that was Bruno's secret. What was one of Bruno's secrets? He figured out ways to divide up words into two-letter groups, and each of these two-letter groups had an established image. And so you would have these groups, and you would just be able to rattle off entire pages of text verbatim. And then there's the way that you're using this whole thing as a combinatorial method, as an algebra of ideas. So you have all these ideas stored in your head, and you say, okay, what if I look at it this way, and the wheel clicks one over? And so and so it becomes a tool for thinking. And then there are magical dimensions also, which he goes out of his way not to make clear, but they're very clearly there in the book. You can tell this because so many of the images in a certain portion of it are magical images. So you're obviously very deliberately using these images of astrological magic to call down power from the stars to strengthen your memory work. How that works, I'm still working on it.
Is there anything that you think we've missed that's key to the system?
No, I think we've basically covered the core of it.
Oh, okay.
Other than that, it's a matter of pick up the book and see how much sense you can make of it. Bruno's sitting there tapping his fingers, waiting for you to catch up to him.
Pick up the book and actually do the work. That's
Yeah,
always the
that's
thing that's
usually.
stopping people.
Oh yeah, that's all. I mean, that's always the thing. You know, here you have the instructions. You can have a fantastic memory and the capacity to combine ideas and think creatively in ways that most people don't, if you're willing to work at it.
Like, even though I dislike his work and him quite a bit, like Woody Allen says, half of life is just showing up.
Exactly. Exactly. The other half is doing something once you show up.
Fair point. Most people don't even leave, so there you go.
Yeah, exactly.
So are you working on anything at the moment? Have you is your I just saw that, is it Voyage to Hyperborea?
Voyage to Hyperborea. So yeah, the my tentacle fiction, my series of H.P. Lovecraft fantasias, epic fantasies with tentacles. Well, tentacles, pseudopods, gill slits. That is finally done. Voyage to
Sorry.
Hyperborea is the next to last. The last one, the Seal of Yue Lao, is in the hands of the publisher now and should be out within a month or so. And so, with 11 volumes of tentacle fantasy, I think that I kind of drew a line under it. I'd said basically everything that could be said by Shoggoths and great old ones and attractive young women with tentacles for legs. So,
After 11 volumes, you said to me in our Lovecraft interview that it was turning out then to be some of your most important work. Do you now con what would you consider it just as important now after all this
oh
time?
yeah, no, I think it needed to be written, and I think it really communicates some things very well. We'll see if the readers agree, but it's apparently, I mean, it's become kind of a minor cult classic, which is about what I was hoping.
Really?
No, I hear from a lot of people here and there who I'd never heard of before, who are going, wow, I like the tentacle stuff. So we'll see how it goes. But
Anything
but
else in
so
the
yeah
pipeline
that
after that?
oh yeah, I'm a professional writer. I always have stuff. I've got, let's see, what do I have going? In process right now, I have a book. Which will probably be thrown across the room against the far wall more often than anything else I have ever written or will ever
Oh,
write.
is it a book on Crowley or Gurdjieff?
No, it's a book. No. This one's going to fly even further than that. The working title is "The King in Orange: Magical Politics in the Age of Trump."
Oh, okay, so is this, have you read Gary Lachman's Dark Star Rising?
Yes, I've read Dark Star Rising. I was very disappointed in it.
Oh, why is that?
I first of all, Lachman buys into the standard media version of what the whole Trump phenomenon is about, which to my mind is simply clueless. It's all, oh, Russian, the evil Russians doing this and blah de blah. And he hasn't bothered to put the whole thing in its act in the context of the actual economic and political factors that drove the rise of Trump, that in fact made him or someone like him inevitable. He hasn't dealt with the archetypal dimension of the whole thing at all. He hasn't dealt with the way that Johan Kuoleanu used to talk about how modern societies are magician states. They don't get conformity by jackboots. They get conformity by dominating the narrative and by making it impossible for people to think unapproved thoughts. And the political mainstream in America, up until Donald Trump, was a classic example of that, where the one thing that nobody was allowed to talk about is why is it that in 1970, a working class family on one income had a decent life, a home, a car, etc. And in 2000, and a working class family with one income was living on the street. What happened? Why aren't we talking about this? It was huge. It was the biggest social, it was the biggest socioeconomic fact of American public life, and nobody would discuss it. That was the thing that drove the rise of Donald Trump. And I, but I get into that, and I get into the archetypal dimension, the way that magic has, the magic as such has been explicitly used by both sides, rather more effectively on the right than on the left, and so on and so on and so on. But as I said, it's going to be flung, it's going to be flung across rooms many, many times.
Well, any good book needs to have dents in it.
Oh yeah, this is my great aerodynamic book. So I have that in process. I have a book on occult training that's in process.
What
I'm exploring.
system?
Oh yeah, no, I'm inventing. At this point, I've been able to refine down some of my ideas, not so much with in terms of ceremonial magic, but the study of occult philosophy, the basic elements of occult training that anyone who wants to get involved in occultism should do, the meditation, and so on. So that's in process and is coming along very nicely. And I'm exploring some other possibilities in fiction right now as well. So we'll see where it goes.
That's great. Okay, John. Unless you've got anything else to add, thanks very much.
No, I'm good with it.
Okay, thank you.